Hi, and welcome to another episode of The Economist Corner, a CETA podcast where leading economists break down the latest news and policy updates. I'm Jared Ball, Chief Economist of CETA, the Committee for Economic Development of Australia. Before we get started, I'd like to take a few seconds for you to rate and subscribe to our podcasts. This means you get new episodes in your phone as soon as they go live. And of course, rating our show helps others find it too. So thanks for doing that. Today, we're looking at the role of housing in Australia's economic recovery. There is a solid argument for stimulating the housing sector in this recession, but we need to be careful about how this support is targeted to avoid unintended consequences. That's the verdict of a new paper published by CETA. I'm joined now by its authors, Curtin University Professor of Economics, Professor Rachel Ong Vaforge, and she's also a member of CETA's Council on Economic Policy. And of course, University of Adelaide Director of the Centre for Housing, Urban and Regional Planning, Professor Chris Leishman. Perhaps, Rachel, if I could start with you. The paper begins by highlighting how housing became a driver of economic outcomes in Australia well before COVID-19. And of course, we see this on a daily basis, really, in the headlines. So what are the impacts in terms of housing as a driver of economic outcomes from your perspective?
Well, housing has traditionally been viewed by policymakers as a social policy objective, and that's usually rightfully linked to the importance of the human right to shelter. But in recent years, what we've seen is an increase in the recognition of the economic impacts of housing. And this is probably most obvious with respect to the housing dilemmas that are faced by key workers who provide essential services. And by that, I mean our teachers, our firemen, our ambulance drivers, etc. And the key worker dilemma is that as metropolitan housing markets have become less affordable, the key workers' earnings have been increasingly insufficient to access housing in metropolitan areas. And so the provision of essential frontline services will suffer. So that's one economic impact that a lack of housing affordability might have. Another important impact that housing has on the economy is the disruption that can be caused by having to frequently move home. So in Australia, a significant share of low to moderate income households rent from private landlords. And our private rental sector does make up quite a large share of the housing stock in Australia, about a quarter. We have weak rent regulation in the private rental sector and little tenure security by international standards. So what happens is that those households living in the private rental sector can at times be forced to move more frequently than what they would like to. And this can be quite disruptive for, say, the schooling of children and even the education and learning outcomes of adults. And this in turn would have knock-on impacts on their lifetime economic prospects. Another area that's increasingly recognized as an economic impact of housing is the fact that unaffordable housing can increase commuting times. So we know that households are increasingly being pushed to the urban fringe in their search for affordable housing. And the longer one spends time in commuting, the more it reduces one's productivity. And if a person is living far away from innovation centers, it can also reduce opportunities for new business startups as well.
Thanks, Rachel. I mean, I think that's a really good summary of the economic issues as they stand around housing. And if I could just turn to you, Chris, just to kind of further that, in what ways do you think COVID-19 has immediately changed the conversation around housing policy?
Thanks, Jared. Yeah, I mean, I think from my point of view, you know, the most striking immediate impact of the pandemic was actually, you know, the sudden importance that housing took on, you know, in a number of different ways. So, I mean, we know that governments all around the world locked down their populations, you know, as a sort of immediate reaction to the pandemic. And that instantly meant that our homes became all sorts of different things. They became workplaces, places of education and learning. They became virtual meeting rooms as well. We all got very used to team meetings and Zoom meetings. And of course, our homes became sanctuaries as well. So places of safety, places of security, and you know, shelter. And so in effect, housing also became a really important public health weapon. And so one good example of that, of course, is that homeless people were taken off the street in many countries, including in Australia, and they were housed in temporary accommodation and hotel accommodation. And of course, that wasn't particularly for their benefit directly, but actually, you know, reflected a public health response designed to slow down the spread of the pandemic. So overnight, really, housing just sort of transformed and accelerated in terms of importance, both from a personal point of view and a public health point of view, and also an economic point of view. Our housing let us continue our jobs, working from home, and you know, in many ways, kept the economy on track. But I think it's important to recognize also that, you know, some aspects of housing policy are less well-defined than they could have been. So governments around the world were very quick to act in terms of saving jobs and supporting people's incomes, trying to keep the economy on track, in other words. In Australia, the interventions in housing markets, I think, were much less well-defined and much more uncertain. Than interventions in other aspects of the economy. So, for example, there wasn't really a national policy position in Australia. And, you know, the states and the territories actually had a wide range of different housing policies. In terms of the private rental sector, you know, landlords and tenants were effectively encouraged to talk to each other. They were encouraged to enter voluntary arrangements. But there wasn't a large-scale sort of national intervention as such. But of course, most jurisdictions did have things like, you know, a temporary ban on evictions. But I think it's in general fair to say that housing interventions were quite a light touch compared to other forms of economic intervention during the pandemic.
And so that gives me a fantastic segue for my next question to Rachel, Chris, which is, you know, you've talked there about, you know, public policy interventions. Obviously, the big public policy intervention that we usually see during economic downturns is the kind of go-to stimulus of trying to get more residential construction moving. I guess the question for you, Rachel, does this work as a stimulus, and given it's used so often during economic downturns, is it an effective stimulus tool?
Yes, Jared. So residential construction has definitely been the go-to stimulus option during economic downturns. We've seen that during the most recent federal budget, and we've seen that in the Home Builder Program that the government implemented this year. And we've also seen that when the GFC hit during 2008 and 2009, residential construction was the go-to option. And to a degree, yes, it does work in the short term. Governments usually justify construction stimulus based on the multiplier effect, which is a macroeconomic perspective. So the rationale is that the government would inject a certain amount of expenditure into the construction industry. And in the case of the Home Builder Program, it's $25,000 for each successful application. So this is in turn expected to increase national output and employment to meet the additional demand created by these government stimulus programs. And the multiplier for the residential construction industry is usually thought to be one of the highest in the Australian economy. For instance, the National Housing Finance and Investment Corporation, or NIFIC, has estimated that $1 million of residential building construction output would support nearly $3 million of industry output and consumption across the Australian economy. So it's really unsurprising that the government has targeted the construction industry for spending injection during this COVID economic crisis. But the problem, of course, is that the multiplier effect is not perfect and it can be short-lived. There are also other unintended consequences with respect to the government's COVID-19 housing stimulus package. I'll perhaps leave it to Chris to talk more about this housing package specifically.
Yeah, no, that would be great, Chris. I mean, Rachel has really outlined, I guess, some of the theory around multipliers and the impact of residential construction on stimulus. But in talking about the Home Builder Package specifically, putting aside that kind of immediate kind of sugar hit to the economy, what are some of the broader
kind of economic impacts of it and perhaps some of the unintended consequences that we should be mindful of.
Yeah, thanks, Jared. Yeah, I mean, I think that lots of housing and economic commentators are looking at home builder and wondering whether, you know, it's the first step in a series of stimulus measures or whether it is actually the sum total of the stimulus and the interventions. But I think it's fair to say that home builder was introduced pretty quickly. It's not particularly targeted. And the way it works, you know, we think that it's probably stimulated demand that was there anyway. So in other words, the people who had some savings, people who are going to buy a house or build or refurbish a house anyway in the next perhaps 6 to 12 months, might have been triggered into action a bit quicker. And so it has brought forward demand, it stimulated some demand. And we know that from talking to developers and house builders, which we've been doing recently in the course of various research projects, you know, the home builder package has been well received. And the industry does think it's helped things, it's helped protect jobs, it's stimulated some demand, you know, but there's a worry about what happens next. And I think many developers that we've spoken to think, you know, that they've got a cliff coming. And so further into 2021, when the immediate stimulus effects of home builder run out, they're worried about what comes next. And there's a concern that the demand that was going to exist in 2021 has simply been brought forward to, you know, the late stages of 2020. And so there is that concern about what happens next. In terms of unintended consequences, you know, almost by definition, people who were sitting ready to build or buy anyway, who had savings and have been triggered into action a bit quicker, you know, tend not to be the most needy people in society. And so there's a concern that it will actually further exacerbate inequalities. So, you know, people who are relatively affluent anyway and may own a house or be looking at buying investment properties may actually be well poised to increase their position. And so it doesn't really do much for housing shortages or housing inequality or more widely.
Thanks, Chris. And I think that, you know, the macro timing issue is a really important one and obviously goes across the board in terms of fiscal stimulus and bringing things forward that the more you change the timing, you potentially leave a gap later on. So it's a really important point. Rachel, just coming to you, you mentioned in your opening comments issues around the private rental market. Mm. And the paper notes that this is an area that really policy after COVID has left the private rental market alone. Do you think there's room to do more in the private rental market? Are there some policy interventions that we would want to see?
Yeah, definitely. So the COVID-19 housing stimulus package has been heavily directed towards people who are well-placed to purchase housing or well-placed to increase their investment in property. So these sorts of intervention would be likely to exacerbate inequalities in wealth and in income in Australia. So this is an issue, and interventions that have been directed at lower income households have been weaker and less generous in comparison. Now, when you look at the private rental sector, you'll see that the Commonwealth government has largely left the sector to its own devices. They've encouraged landlords and renters, for instance, to negotiate regarding rent arrangements. But there has been no direct government intervention regarding rent levels or how one might deal with the backlog of unpaid rent that might arise from job losses. So those are some issues there in terms of the private rental sector being largely left alone to its own devices. We know that states and territories have rolled out eviction moratoriums and rent relief programs during the pandemic, but these have come to an end, and these are temporary and time-limited measures. So what happens as these interventions come to an end to those who are precariously housed? What happens as these interventions come to an end, as the job seeker payment is also being reduced and the job keeper payment is also being reduced? It does seem highly possible to me that evictions and homelessness might rise in 2021 because the measures that have been directed at the private rental sector have been so time limited and temporary. So I think that what we need to do is to take a longer term approach when we look at the private rental sector, because most of the people who are living in the private rental sector tend to be on lower incomes, and they tend to be people who do not own any property. And by longer term thinking, I mean thinking about opportunities around expanding the social housing stock. We know that there are nearly 150,000 applicants on the public housing waitlist nationally, and these are people who are eligible for public housing. However, we know that the supply of the social housing stock is highly rationed relative to demand. So there's a real opportunity here to look at spending on expanding the social housing stock in order to address the long wait list that we're facing. There has been no funding in the federal budget to boost a further expansion in social housing, and this has been disappointing because there has been a largely unified call from the housing sector and from economists for some of the stimulus spending to be directed towards affordable housing. Now, that's not been in the government's federal budget agenda at all. And we also really need to start thinking more about housing tax reforms that shift the preferential tax treatment of housing away from those who are on higher incomes towards those who are on lower incomes. Because at the moment, the way that we tax housing really benefits Australian homeowners and investors at the expense of renters. And these sort of non-neutral tax arrangements can result in efficiency losses, and they're certainly not equitable.
So you've drawn a nice link there, Rachel, between the private rental market and social housing construction, and just the links between those two areas. And obviously, to the extent that you have large social housing waiting lists, that potentially puts even more pressure on the private rental market and brings more vulnerable people into that market. Chris, perhaps if I could ask you the tough question on social housing. Why do you think that it's been largely overlooked? Is it that the Commonwealth and the states can't come to an agreement on this? What do you think the big impediment is?
Well, I think, you know, it's ultimately it is a political question rather than an economic one. You know, so the economic case has been well made, actually. Large-scale investment in social house building would stimulate the construction sector. It would protect jobs after the short-term positive effects of home builder have ended. This investment creates a multiplier effect, which is well documented. It benefits other sectors in the economy, apart from construction. And of course, there would be an improvement in terms of inequality. And there would be a boost to productivity, particularly in cities. So, you know, trying to explain why there is no such policy is actually very difficult through an economic lens. You know, I think the federal government sees housing as a state matter, so far appears to be reluctant to intervene, even when there is this overwhelming economic case in favour of such an intervention.
I think there's a need for longer term thinking. So we know, for instance, that research has shown that social housing can be beneficial for children's educational outcomes. So there are economic benefits for the next generation. For future generations. So these are benefits that we're not going to reap straight away. And obviously there's a cost that goes into the construction of social housing, but there is quite a huge need for policymakers to be willing to make that shift towards longer term thinking, I think, on this front. And I also think that just drawing that link between social housing and the private rental sector, I think if there is an unwillingness on the part of policymakers to invest more in social housing, then they really need to take a good look at the issues that are being faced by low-income private renters and work to make the private rental sector a more affordable and secure sector. So we know, for instance, that the main subsidy that's paid to low-income private renters is the Commonwealth Rent Assistance. And the rent assistance rate has just not kept up with rent increases over time. And many different organizations, you know, such as the Productivity Commission, ACOS, and you know, researchers and economists alike have made an observation that what we really need to do is to look at increasing the rent assistance rate in order to reduce housing stress amongst low-income private renters. So there are really many different options and many different things that one can do in order to improve the circumstances of low-income renters, whether it be in the private rental sector or the social housing sector. And these will have positive economic outcomes. Secure and affordable tenure will mean better educational outcomes for children, probably improved job search prospects, just because one has a stable address. So there really is much that we could do where the rental sector is concerned.
So a really good point that you make around Commonwealth Rent Assistance, Rachel, and amongst all of those economists and people who have argued for an increase, CEDA in its report last year on disrupting disadvantage did the same as well. Maybe we could end on the issue around tax, and you've mentioned some of the opportunities there, Rachel. Obviously, last election, I think really the kind of policies that were seen around negative gearing and capital gains, perhaps the kind of election result has left those opportunities go for the time being. But is there, on the other hand, we've seen in places like the ACT where they have managed to bring about reform in stamp duties in moving to a land tax. Is the kind of appetite and opportunity, do you think, at the moment for state level kind of changes to property taxes as a way of kind of building momentum towards broader change?
Oh, I don't feel very positive on this front, to be honest, and I'm sorry to be so pessimistic. So unfortunately, I don't really see any appetite for change in these areas, with the exception of the ACT. At the Commonwealth level, for instance, housing tax reform has just not featured in the government's economic recovery strategy. And we know that there are some really sensible reasons as to why we should reform the way we tax housing. For instance, just look at stamp duty. I mean, economists all agree that there is no strong efficiency or equity rationale for imposing stamp duty on property purchase. And we know that land tax is a far more efficient option. We also do know that those who benefit the most from negative gearing provisions are those who are on higher income tax brackets. So, by quarantining negative gearing provisions, we could achieve some fiscal savings, and this would come from relatively wealthy property investors. So I think there is a real need for political courage to make some difficult choices that may not be too popular in the short term with higher income property owners, but which we know will yield efficiency and equity benefits in the long term. I think we also need, we need to be open. I think policymakers need to be open to perhaps transitional arrangements if there are concerns that some of these housing tax reforms might have an impact on the housing market that are undesirable. So, for instance, there are fears that negatively geared investors might leave the market, leave the property market if negative gearing provisions were tightened. But some of these issues can be dealt with through to properly designed transitional arrangements where these reforms are phased in over a long period of time. I mean, the ACT ACT tax reform design is one such example where the arrangements are phased in over quite a long period of time. So I think, on the positive side, I think that openness to transitional arrangements and the willingness to make some of these difficult choices will actually benefit the Australian population in the longer term. But if we do continue to shy away from these politically difficult reforms and just continue to go to stimulus measures that favour wealthy property investors, then I'm afraid the housing stimulus path out of this economic crisis will not be an equitable one.
And perhaps, Chris, are you any more optimistic than Rachel on this?
I think we do face a particular opportunity at the moment. I mean, I see that 2021 brings an opportunity to have another look at this case for investing in social house building in particular. And, you know, I think in the end, there are sort of three principal arguments to support the idea of investing in social house building. And just thinking about what they are, I mean, the first one really is we need to reflect that even advanced economies will always tend to have some people, some households who can't reasonably be expected to be housed in a market system. So there might be people who are too sick, disabled, or old to work, and they don't have sufficient savings to fall back on. You know, if we think that Australia has a huge shortfall, actually, in social and affordable housing, and it's really well demonstrated by the enormous and rising waiting lists. So we actually have an opportunity at the moment when demand is slack in the construction sector to take advantage of that and take a big chunk out of that problem and actually reduce Australia's inequality. You know, the second argument we've outlined in this discussion is the obvious need to stimulate the construction sector and the rest of the economy in 2021. So we've outlined the multiplier effect. The construction sector is well known for its large multiplier effect. So government money spent on construction triggers all sorts of other increases in demand that benefit supply chains, transportation, retail, and other forms of consumption. So, you know, spending money on social house building is actually one of the most effective ways to stimulate the economy. And the research we've carried out recently suggests that actually the construction industry does need it. It needs more stimulus to keep going and avoid job losses after the home builder intervention ends. And, you know, finally, the third argument is a bit less well known, actually, but might be one of the most important. So we know that expensive, unaffordable housing markets are associated with two sort of interlinked problems. And these are low labor market mobility and a low supply of low to moderate waged labor in cities. So low labor market mobility is probably one of the main explanations for the unwillingness of unemployed people to leave cities in search of alternative employment. And that's driven by high housing costs. It's driven by the fear of being unable to return to the cities, to the housing markets in due course. And, you know, high housing costs also make it very difficult for key workers to locate in cities. You know, so for example, imagine trying to find a private rental in Sydney as a part-time social worker or a teacher. It'd be practically impossible. So by providing more social and affordable housing, we can actually boost the supply of various categories of labour that actually increase economic productivity. So there is actually a very strong economic productivity argument in favour of this sort of intervention, in addition to the stimulus arguments that we're facing at the moment.
So a little bit of pessimism on the tax side, but certainly a little bit more optimism perhaps on the social housing side, and the fact that in 2021, depending on the economic circumstances, governments may have no choice but to invest in social housing in terms of some of the levers that they can pull in terms of fiscal stimulus. So I think that's probably a good place to end the podcast on a somewhat positive note. Thank you so much, Rachel and Chris, for your insightful paper and for joining us on the podcast.
Thanks very much.
Thanks, Jared. Thank you.
Thanks for listening in to The Economist Corner. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast on your preferred platform. And for more coverage, such as our blogs and live streams, jump on the CEDA website, ceda.com.au. And finally, keep up to date with everything CEDA is doing in real time by following CEDA on social media. You'll even find me there too, and always happy to take people's questions and feedback, including on the podcast. Please tune in next time, and until then, stay safe.